We have a very special guest here today, as we always do have a very special guest, and I know how often you love me repeating that exact phrase. My very special guest today is a peace activist, one of the most prominent in New Zealand. He's an author, and he basically is going to give us a big lowdown on how New Zealand works truly in the world of war. His name is Nicky Hager, and I'd like to welcome him now to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Nicky, are you there?
Hello.
Give us a little bit of a breakdown about yourself and let us know what you do.
For the last 20 years of my life, I've worked writing books, sometimes writing for the newspaper, and what I've specialised in is researching subjects which are hard to find out about. That's what's going on inside intelligence agencies and what's going on inside political parties and governments and public relations, which I think is an important area that needs more study by all of us. And most recently, a long, several-year study of what our country, New Zealand, was doing in Afghanistan and the war on terror. So that's what I do. I spend my time interviewing insiders, interviewing military people, intelligence people. I spend long days digging into documents and other kinds of sources and then piecing it together so I can present things to the public.
So I'd act under the assumption that when you do present it to the public yourself, they get the full story, but when you're presenting something to the media, they might make it a tad bit myopic?
For example, I just had this big book come out. It's 400 and something pages. And so I don't have to put it out till I'm pretty sure I've got everything right. But the stage of getting it into the media, and in Little New Zealand, my books do will make news when they come out, is always the most depressing part of the process, because it tends to be quite trivial, and normal news media don't handle complex subjects very well. But I just endure that stage, and the idea of a book, of course, is that people read it rather than they hear about the news anyway.
I'm in a problem here, Nicky, because I generally just don't read. I instead go and interview the authors and try and figure out what they really want to say and what the most important points that are on their mind truly is. And so let's talk about that. What are the things that you really wish to portray in this book that you don't think was given any appropriate airtime in the media thus far?
In New Zealand, if you're an ordinary New Zealander watching the news for the last 10 years, most of the time, for a start, you didn't even know that your country was at war. We've been involved in, New Zealand's been involved in our longest overseas war in our history, which was in Afghanistan and a stint in Iraq. But most of the time, it's been completely not in the news. When it has been in the news, it's been a kind of a curious, detached, good news story. It's been like there were bombs going off and there were people fighting, but New Zealanders weren't there. They were off helping people. We were there giving aid and doing nice things and somehow detached from the war which the rest of the world was talking about. And the reason for that was very simple, which was that the defence public relations people in the government realised that not many New Zealanders, most New Zealanders, did not support being part of this on and on incoherent Afghanistan war. And so it was simplest just not to tell them about all the bits that they that they wouldn't agree with. And so my main objective in what was years of research was interviewing soldiers on the ground, interviewing our special forces, who are the most secret soldiers we had there, and then going from that and interviewing people who had been intelligence officers and finding out about the intelligence roles we had in Afghanistan and being able to tell New Zealanders the real story of what they were involved in there, so that they could actually have the opportunity and the right to have an opinion on it.
Well, elaborate. What is that they were saying to you?
My
perspective is Afghanistan is about one thing and one thing only, heroin.
Actually, I don't agree. Some parts of Afghanistan, some of the internal politics and the money of it are about heroin. For a little country like New Zealand, you can reduce it down to another word, which is called alliances. That even in our intelligence services and our military, you get to the actual individuals like the ones I was talking to, and they're pretty sceptical of the US military. They were highly sceptical of the point of going to Afghanistan. At the beginning of the book, I quote this intelligence report written by one of our special forces intelligence officers, where she wrote that there was no reason to go to a war in Afghanistan, that it wasn't, the people in Afghanistan weren't to blame for the September 11 attacks on the whole, that most of them were part of civil wars that were nothing to do with New Zealand, and then if the military did go there, it was going to get bogged down in the civil war across the Pakistan border that wouldn't go anywhere. So there were people in our military who knew that it wasn't a good idea. So why on earth were we there? And the reason for that was, and again I had to gradually get interviews and documents to show this in great detail, was the story of a little country in a big world, basically, that not our soldiers, but our more slippery and cynical foreign affairs officials and diplomats and people didn't see the September 11 attacks as a terrible tragedy. They saw it as a fantastic opportunity. They saw it as an opportunity to get closer to the United States government and to maybe get some benefits, some trade benefits or diplomatic benefits out of that. So, as we sent ship after ship into the Persian Gulf and one after another special forces groups into the Afghanistan mountains, and one after another intelligence officers posted inside different U.S. intelligence headquarters involved in the wars, and thinking behind it was not how to make the world a safer place or how to affect the warlords or heroin or something. It was all about how to get closer to the U.S. government. It was just a kind of a diplomatic game.
It's sort of like the diplomatic equivalent of seeing somebody fall over after you, in front of you, and then come in and cozy on up to them, and then have them see you as sort of their savior and be absolutely loving and caring for you and build a nice relationship sort of thing out of tragedy, as you do.
It's all about what your motives are. It's often the same activity can be a good activity or a bad activity, depending on what your motives are. And New Zealand's ones were, at the level on the ground, the individual soldiers I was talking to and the people who were there, mostly the average New Zealand soldier is a pretty good representative of the values of this country, which are reasonably generous and actually that they really cared about trying to help. But at the bigger level, it was really cynical and we shouldn't have been there.
Well, let's talk about the cynicism then. I mean, what exactly does New Zealand have to gain from spending, what is it now, $1 billion a year or something odd to keep the SAS there? How much are we spending? How much are we getting? Are we talking about trade deals being facilitated here?
The figures of how much we spend, it's hard to say. Our military is a small military, but it's still about $2 billion a year, which is a lot in a 4-million-person country. And its main focus for 10 years has been the war on terror in Afghanistan. What do we gain from it? And this is where it gets really mushy, because if New Zealand was in line for a fantastic trade deal with the United States, perhaps it would be cynical but sort of rational. But what I came to the conclusion was that it was more like it was cynical, but it was sentimental, that there weren't cold, hard national interests at stake. It was more diplomats who maybe had in the earlier in their career they'd been involved in the Cold War and the Cold War kind of view of us and them. And it wasn't actually about what was best for New Zealand or best for the world. It was actually just a kind of a feeling that the right thing they should do was to be close to the US. And I know this doesn't sound like very rational, but I don't think it was very rational.
Well, see, and again, what exactly are we losing here and what are we gaining? Because when I look at intelligence services, the military, ultimately you're dealing with situations that are life and death. And when you're surrounding yourself with subject matter that involves life and death, bending of the truth is always the first priority. I think it was Smedley Butler who said that the first casualty of war is always the truth.
Yeah. Well, as I said, that the benefits are really obscure for a little country like New Zealand. In terms of our security, the best thing we could have done in a time of conflict and terrorism would have been to keep our heads down and to help in ways which weren't joining wars. What did it cost us? That's a much more interesting question. I think it probably hurt New Zealand's security a bit. You know, it was no coincidence that the follow-up terrorist attacks in the world were in Britain and Australia and Spain, who were the most enthusiastic countries to join in the US war on terror. And sadly, it is not surprising that they were the targets. And there are many countries which probably worried about terrorism, but they were never in much risk, and New Zealand was one of those. So we had a minor increase in risk there, but not really. I think the main downside for New Zealand, from my point of view, is that we are, in this country, quite a rare beast in the world. We're a very free, unusually democratic country compared to most countries in the world. We are reasonably uncorrupt. We've got a friendly and pretty secure environment. And from that, you have an opportunity. We're not staring at some hideous, powerful neighbour across a small border and having to trade off our futures to be secure. We're remarkably free, and that gives us an opportunity. And that opportunity is that we can speak out on what we believe in. And New Zealand's done that a lot of times in its history. We're a little country that sent off warships to protest against French testing in the Pacific in the 70s. In the 80s, we introduced a nuclear-free policy. We were a country that was highly involved in setting up the United Nations, and our diplomats from a tiny little country here were very big in the drafting of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So a small country like New Zealand, or like a Scandinavian country, which is free and lucky enough to not be in the middle of conflict and rich enough that it's not dragged down by poverty and things, has a special role it can play in the world, which is an independent role where you speak up for what you think is right, where there are voices which aren't just scared and cynical. And that's what New Zealand has done, and we could have done in the war on terror. And it was selling out that role. It was not being principled, and it was not speaking up in a principled way, which I see as being the greatest loss of that whole decade of our history. And we sold it out for basically nothing, for some people's vision that close military relations with the United States was somehow a hugely beneficial thing, which it's not.
Which means that somebody else benefited from our non-benefit, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah, and who benefited from what we did? It's when a little country like New Zealand goes into a war, we are not offering very much in the way of firepower. What we're offering is our good name, our moral support. And so that's why when you see that the lineup of who's of a war, of the sides of it, they don't say how many guns come from New Zealand. They just put a New Zealand flag, and it's saying, good, principled little country says this war's okay. And that helps to justify the war going on. So we gave our moral support to a war which we shouldn't have been giving it to.
So, in essence, we broke our morals in order to give moral support to an immoral war.
That's precisely what was being offered. And because that would be repugnant to most New Zealanders, there's actually the New Zealand culture for decades has been getting less militaristic from our first imperial little British colony days, where we would rush off to any colonial war where our British cousins and grandparents had led us to. Nowadays, New Zealanders don't agree with that, which is why, as I said at the beginning, the only way that New Zealand could be this willing participant in the war was because New Zealanders were kept in the dark about it. So it's strange politics of sort of elite view of what should happen versus what the public gets told.
Well, let's talk about the elite, because we've got a lot of people who have come into government now who were part of large-scale international corporations, organizations like the United Nations and World Health Organization, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, in the case of our Prime Minister, John Key. So there is a very international flavor with our new parliament, and I have no doubt that they'll be re-elected this year because, well, basically, they've managed to successfully continue to keep New Zealanders in the dark. And the fact that they're able to do that means that New Zealand is not really an independent country. And it is, in fact, very much influenced, if not very much controlled, by outsider forces and people who are more or less acting as agents for those who are not New Zealand citizens and don't have New Zealand at heart.
Yeah, I found that very clearly in the research for my book. You had not ordinary New Zealanders, not even the ordinary soldiers or intelligence officers, but at the high level. I was assisted greatly, actually, by the WikiLeaks releases of cables. I could go through the cables of where these... This was the US Embassy in Wellington. These were part of the huge worldwide leak of WikiLeaks materials. I could go through their cables where they were reporting on their contacts with their local friends. And this was the senior members of the Ministry of Defence. It was senior foreign affairs people, senior business people, certain politicians. And you're quite right. The picture which emerged was that these people were not in tune with the rest of their country. They were part of a cozy elite. That's the usual word which is used for that. These were people who did very nicely out of their worldview and were not in tune with ordinary Polynesian, more peaceful kind of New Zealanders.
And we'll have to talk about more of this after the break. My very amazing guest with a lot of insight is Nikki Hager, coming at us live from New Zealand. And we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Now you and your family and friends can enjoy the cleanest, most delicious, and healthy drinking water anytime, even while traveling, camping, at sporting events, or in emergency situations. The Berkeleyte removes bacteria, cysts, parasites, and harmful chemicals to below detectable levels. It also reduces nitrates and unhealthy minerals like lead and mercury, while leaving in the beneficial and nutritional minerals your body needs. Berkeleyte is so powerful, it can even purify raw, untreated water from remote lakes and streams. And the optional PF2 filters even remove fluoride. The Berkeleyte LED, with its rechargeable lighting system, can be used as a nightlight or a camp light. To view or purchase your Berkey water system and replacement filters, please visit American Freedom Radio's website at AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click the Berkey banner. Once again, that's AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And click the Berkey Water banner. Not yet available in Iowa.
Most Americans know the significance of July 4th, 1776. However, few know the importance of September 17th, 1787, the day the Constitution was written and adopted by our founders. Unfortunately, over 200 years later, this sacred document is under attack, along with our beloved Republic. Throughout the span of history, brave men and women have rallied behind banners, which have served as symbols of liberty against the forces of tyranny. Today, we have the Constitution Pride flag to show our support for the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, freedom, liberty, and justice for we the people of the United States. Now available at www.1787flags.com. Get your very own Constitution Pride flag today and receive a free pocket Constitution with your order. www.1787flags.com, the official website of the Constitution Pride flag. That's www.1787flags.com.
What is it that's in your home that causes grown men to cower and children to run for cover?
Fun!
Food storage!
That's right. Food storage shouldn't be scary. At Simply Your Food, we are the premier providers of long-term, storable, GMO, and MSG-free meats, veggies, fruit, dairy, and pantry essentials like powdered butter. We even have a gluten-free line. Food storage shouldn't be scary. Let Simply Your Food help you with your food storage needs. Go to simplyyourfood.com or call 866-251-7511 and let us take the scary out of food storage. Go to simplyyourfood.com or call 866-251-7511 and let us take the scary out of food storage.
Are you suffering from issues related to angina pain, high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, unbalanced cholesterol, irregular heartbeats, clogged arteries? If so, you are not alone. Millions of people are suffering from one or more of these problems. If you'd like to live your life free of sickness, pain, and fear, live your life with increased vitality, energy, and youthfulness, and experience your body healing itself, then this might be the most important message you'll ever hear. An effective 100% organic nutritional supplement is now available. Heart and Body Extract is an exclusive formula of wild-crafted and organic herbs. It is extremely effective and starts to work within days. Get your Heart and Body Extract today by visiting heartandbody.com or by calling 866-295-5305, 866-295-5305, or heartandbody.com.
Welcome to the world's meeting place. American.
It's practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
Listen to the Ron Paul Revolution Radio Show with Rossi and Brocky. Join the revolution on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 3 to 5 p.m. Central, and only on American Freedom Radio.
Yeah. Yeah. And no one like me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Congratulations, you made it. Welcome to the Crusader. It's been a long time coming, yo.
Yeah,
but I'm here now. So what you wanna do? How many dudes you really know can flow like this, like this? Like this, let's do it. How many dudes you know vote like this? How many dudes you know flow like this? Not many, if any, not many, if any. How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this?
Nobody rocks a show like this. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the most gangster 2 hours in talk radio. Talking up a storm and exposing the gangster, prankster, bangster, scumbaggery filth that it reside in Parliament and in the very nice finance houses of the world, basically, especially in Deutsche Bank. Nikki, welcome back.
Hi there.
Okay, so we wanted to get into the meat and potatoes of this. So you're talking about the sort of elite of New Zealand, those who are very much detached from the average person, you know, belonging, if you will, to a lot of organisations, some of which are secret, some of which are public, that basically don't promote the New Zealand way of life, and ergo, how is it possible for such a people who don't believe in the New Zealand way of life, don't operate under it, to control it?
There's never a simple answer to these things. How does an elite work? If you look at the history of any country, like little New Zealand, there's been a struggle the whole way through. When the settlers came to New Zealand 150 years ago, there were people who came out here for a new life and to get away from the class system of England and set the country on one path. And there were also people who came out here to set up big farms, control industries, and there's been a struggle between those two kinds of directions throughout the whole history of the country. Nowadays, it works at different levels. At the business level, we do have, like in most countries, a concentration of wealth, which means that concentration of wealth affects politics. But when in an area like war, it happens in a different way. It's not that people are born into privilege. It's unfortunately that they work their way up through the Foreign Affairs Ministry or the Defence Forces or the Intelligence Services, and their experiences are such, and this means alliance experiences, are such that they're spending their time at overseas meetings very regularly with Americans and British and Australian equivalents. They're sitting there in joint planning, they're planning joint equipment, they're planning joint training, and gradually the New Zealand worldview kind of gets replaced by, or pushed aside, by the view of their allies. And so that's what I see happening with these people, that they're actually ordinary old New Zealanders at one level, but their whole work lives, running through the decades, the patterns of their lives, their their mates, the people whose faces come into their heads when they're making decisions or thinking about something, are these four-star generals or top intelligence people or their, whatever their equivalents are from other nations rather than the ordinary old folks of their own country. And that's why I call it an elite, but not an elite like a fixed little subculture of society where they live in different houses or something, but a professional group who end up seeing the world through the eyes of other countries rather than their own country's eyes. Does that
Well, you're talking about a globalist elite, you know. I mean, I presume you've heard of the Rothschild family and David Rockefeller, head of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. Have you heard of all of these different subset groups?
I've heard those things, but I don't know anything about that kind of stuff. Not sure.
Okay. Well, it's basically exactly what you described, except it's happening on a global scale. It's not just happening to New Zealand political and business leaders. It's indeed happening with the leaders of virtually every country. They get invited into these meetings, and in so doing, they're capable of disseminating a simultaneous global agenda without anybody in the public knowing about it, because the majority of these goings-on, while public, are certainly not reported and are well in the dark for most of the average public. And this is how the world itself seems to get coordination very rapidly nowadays, because things are planned well in advance. For instance, when we talk about the international coordination with response to the September 11th attacks, they seem to happen very instantly, and things don't normally work that fast in politics. Yet after the September 11th, boom, everything seemed like it was jigsaw puzzles slotting into place without anybody needing to do any sorting. It was just unreal. And for somebody who doesn't know about how international organizations do in fact work as sort of steering committees for world policy, it would seem very surprising. But it's very unsurprising to me, considering the, well, enormous amount of meetings that actually go on in the several groups, and the power players that are actually involved are usually some of the most influential, the wealthiest, and the people that are heads of the media, for example. I was told a story by a friend of mine that she was dating a guy in the New Zealand Herald who was like a lead editor, and he was invited to a thing called a Bilderberg Group meeting. And when he was there, they instructed him not to report about things that would really make people happy and enlighten them or give them more information. They said, instead, report about murders, report about disaster, report about massive weather events and things like that, to keep everybody into a closed-minded, fear-based, dumbed-down paradigm, paraphrasing here, of course. And therefore, we don't have a world that is run by individual countries. We have a world that is instead run by an advanced network of individuals who carry inordinate amounts of influence in their hands because of their massive connections overseas.
Right. I can only talk about the bits which I know well, but what, I'll give you an example of our military. Our military are pretty ordinary kind of people. That they did not get born into the elite of the society when they were young. They were probably born into more ordinary families, and they just worked their way up. But then something happens to them. What I discovered was that although, if you read any defence white papers or something, they say New Zealand's an independent country, we make all our decisions ourselves, we, etc., etc. What I found was, and this is public information, but I accumulated it, was that there are hundreds and hundreds of meetings every year where, when they are planning how to do their training, what new equipment to get, their strategic plans for how the military will be developed over the next 5 years and 20 years. Every single aspect of their future planning and their equipment planning and their doctrine planning, that means that just sort of how they're going to fight and what basis they'll fight on. Everything like that is not worked out in New Zealand working groups. It's decided in a structure. This is a very important structure for to understand for this kind of military politics. If they're planning new planes or new fighting methods, they go off to international meetings, as I say, hundreds of times a year, different offices, and there are five nations represented there. The five nations are New Zealand, Australia, Canada, Britain, and the United States. That, for very long historic reasons, New Zealand and those countries are part of this very tight, sort of white-faced English-speaking alliance, is basically what it's made up of. It comes from the Second World War and before, and the colonial post-war period. And so if New Zealand's deciding what tanks we buy or what new aircraft we buy or anything like that, it will have happened sitting in a room with a British brigadier and American generals and Australians and Canadians. And so when they come back here and make submissions to the government about what equipment they have or where they should be exercising or what their priorities are, it sounds like New Zealand, but it's actually all been happening in these meetings with their Anglo-Saxon brothers and sisters. And the results are inevitable, because if you're the smallest country in the room, you tend to go with what the big ones do. And luckily, I had the minutes of these meetings. They were planning intelligence operations. They were planning military things and purchases and so on. And New Zealanders weren't pushing their weight around. They were mostly just following. And that's the way it happens. It doesn't happen by the military here deciding that they're going to sell out their country or something. It just happens step by step of what they probably think are just natural organizational meetings. But the end result of it is that they're doing what other countries, they're following other countries' priorities rather than anything that's devised in their own country.
Well, there's two concepts that I think that the New Zealand public need to be very well aware of when it comes to geopolitical analysis is compartmentalisation and incrementalism. Compartmentalisation ensures that many people can be involved with one particular goal and have absolutely no idea of the involvement of anybody else, because they're only there to play their part. Not entirely dissimilar to how the Manhattan Project was operated under a need-to-know basis, and they managed to keep it secret, even though something like 100,000 US scientists and various other personnel were involved in the creation of nuclear weapons. So that's how international legislation and just general progression kind of gets planned and implemented. However, it is implemented with the specific strategic control of incrementalism to make sure that people do not react hugely. Like, for example, if I was to tell you, Nikki, that tomorrow we're going to sell every single New Zealand asset and we're going to allow World Bank-affiliated American-owned companies to come into New Zealand, take control of that, and then we're going to increase taxes to record levels and implement austerity cuts and take away everybody's free health care and ratchet up the price on gas monstrously and do all of these things, everybody would be absolutely upset. But if you do the exact same thing over a period of 10 years, nobody says an effing word.
Yeah.
This is how we live. And it's really quite sad, because the media is supposed to expose these types of things going on, because I figured it out. They do report the truth, technically, because they have to. They can't just do straight-up lies, although they have been caught doing that many times. It seems to be that they just, instead of reporting the one fact and whatever, they should, in fact, also be joining the dots and explaining the context. That is lacking.
Of course. I know, and anyone who watches the media in any country can't help but feel that if they look at what they're seeing. But let's not be too pessimistic about it. Let me give you another point of view here, which is that while the military in our country, and I know it's the same in similar countries, worked very hard to hide the things which they knew were going to be unpopular, because they didn't want public support to be removed from their funding and their participation in the wars, while all that was going on, it wasn't all their way. It's never all their way. In New Zealand, for example, over the last few years, there's been more and more information leaking out anyway. So what I'm getting at is we don't want to be too pessimistic about this, because These institutions, the military, even the intelligence services, which I do a lot of work on and interview people in, they're not monolithic. They're not. It's not like every single person there strictly believes the need to know rules and will never speak to anybody, and that they all believe in everything that's going on, because the actual individuals inside these institutions, they're part of the culture of their country. And that these, so you're going to get variety there. And so in New Zealand, we've had more and more stories coming out about what our special forces are there, which have become more and more uncomfortable for the previous government and the current government here. That their comforting reassurances about what New Zealand would and wouldn't be doing have repeatedly been shown to be untrue, and it's become a difficult issue for them, precisely because some people in the media have been doing their job. And it's the same with other parts of the military. And while I feel frustrated at some news organizations, we have to keep in mind that they have to produce 4 stories a day while I can work on a book for 3 years. But then at least we live in a country where I could work on a book for 3 years, and suddenly anyone who wants to read it can find out about the intelligence operations and exactly who they were and the names of the people and particular military things that were hidden, and the fact that our peacekeepers were loading CIA helicopters and helping load explosives rather than doing what we were told they were doing. This stuff does tend to come out. And so we don't want to be too pessimistic and write it off. What we actually have to do is, even if we can't get stuff straight away and the media's held up for a while, the objective should be that you do get it out, and then you get progress in a good direction as well.
Yeah. I mean, it all comes down to the truth as far as I'm concerned. Talk the truth as often as you can, as loud as you can, and nothing bad will actually really come of it. And if some people lose their jobs over it, hey, they shouldn't have been lying.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so while it's possible to chronicle all sorts of abuses of power and things that are going wrong, at the same time, there's all sorts of things which are going right. And history is those two things added together.
Well, like I say, history eventually makes hypocrites of us all.
Yeah.
For what one thing says and what one thing does don't always match up, ladies and gentlemen. So don't be naive. But don't be cynical either, because the key to balance is being able to swing from one extreme to the other and still being able to come nicely back to the centre. You're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest today is Nikki Hager, one of New Zealand's most prominent peace activists and researchers. And we'll be right back after this break.
What would your life be like if you woke up each morning with new vitality, feeling better than you have in years, and you noticed a difference in your sleeping patterns, blood sugar levels, and had a sense of well-being overall? There's something that is changing thousands of people's lives, and you could be one of them. It's called Heart and Body Extract. Sharon Harris, co-creator of Heart and Body Extract, talks about the positive effects of Heart and Body Extract.
What happens with the formula Heart and Body Extract is it's giving the body the necessary vitamins, minerals, amino acids, enzymes, and phytonutrients so the body will heal itself. And yes, the body does have the ability to balance blood pressure, balance cholesterol, clean and unclog the arteries. It can also work on balancing the circulation for diabetics. So the body is an amazing thing. It simply needs some help so it has the tools to heal itself.
Heart and Body Extract gets results. To order your 2-month supply, call now, toll free at 866-295-5305. Order online at hbextract.com.
Do you realize every day we are being put under constant stress from wireless radiation? What's worse is that you don't even know that it's happening. It puts as much stress on our body as if we had a constant viral infection, draining our energy and sapping our strength, or just making us irritable and fatigued. These wireless fields are being emitted from computers, microwaves, mobile phones, power lines, and any electrical appliance. Now there is a solution. A group of research engineers in New Zealand have come up with an active shielding device that shields you from wireless radiation at a cellular level. Blue Shield comes in 3 models: a household, portable, and USB that plugs into any computer. The great thing about Blue Shield is it is very affordable and guaranteed to last. A one-off purchase will see you being protected for years to come. Visit AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the Blue Shield banner. Blue Shield, brought to you by the VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
Feeling stressed, tired, lacking energy, or lacking libido? Now you can take control of your healthcare goals in the privacy of your own home with the use of reliable, high-quality health products from Ideal Health in New Zealand. Conveniently delivered to your door anywhere in the world. You'll find our friendly health team offer well-researched health information plus the highest quality health products. We want to ensure you not only get the best value products available, but also ensure you get the fastest therapeutic results. With over 2,600 pages of health information and natural products, all compiled by our friendly naturopathic team. To take advantage of very special rates, click on the banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And don't forget our convenient delivery service, Ideal Health New Zealand. Leaders in alternative health. That's AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the Ideal Health New Zealand button. Proudly brought to you by the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
Now you and your family and friends can enjoy the cleanest, most delicious, and healthy drinking water anytime, even while traveling, camping, at sporting events, or in emergency situations. The Berkeleyte removes bacteria, cysts, parasites, and harmful chemicals to below detectable levels. It also reduces nitrates and unhealthy minerals like lead and mercury, while leaving in the beneficial and nutritional minerals your body needs. Berkeleyte is so powerful, it can even purify raw, untreated water from remote lakes and streams. And the optional PF2 filters even remove fluoride. The Berkeleyte LED, with its rechargeable lighting system, can be used as a nightlight or a camp light. To view or purchase your Berkey water system and replacement filters, please visit American Freedom Radio's website at AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click the Berkey banner. Once again, that's AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click the Berkey water banner. Not yet available in Iowa.
Online, all the time, your gateway to the world.
AFR
American Freedom Radio.
Give it to them.
Truth Brigade Radio, live Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 p.m. Only on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. The truth has just gotten hotter.
Eastwood Show. Boogieing it down in the Schwarzenegger sense of the word. Coming live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland in the island-chained nation in the slave South Pacific. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Live from New Zealand, live from the future. My guest today is Nikki Hager, investigative journalist and all-round good guy. And we're going to ask him now a very poignant question because we've only got a set amount of time on this show that we have guests on each day. And I feel it's very important for them to use me and use this show platform in a very loving and caring Christian manner, of course, to get out exactly the things that they wish they'd had the opportunity to get out to a wide audience in the first place. So, Nikki, what are some of the things that you've really experienced that have, well, more or less, held the greatest significance and consequence to New Zealand and the world in general through your research as an investigative journalist? And what are the things that have been most covered up?
To me, the story I'd probably most like to tell, for people who haven't heard it. When you do my kind of work, there's lots of subjects you'd like to dig into. I hear things all the time which I think someone should be trying harder on, or something that upsets me, and I think somebody should be trying to find out the truth. And of course, they don't all work. I don't always find the right inside sources. I can dig for ages and just get stonewalled by government agencies or whatever. But sometimes things go incredibly well. And I wouldn't mind telling you about one of those, because anywhere in the world, these kind of breakthroughs only happen very occasionally because there's so much chance and luck involved in it. So I'll give you an example. Several years ago, we had a new leader of our Conservative Party in New Zealand, the National Party. They were in opposition at the time. They're now in government, that party. And the new leader wasn't in for very long. He was a millionaire former banker. And he came up to give his first speech as leader. And what he used that speech for was this astonishingly powerful and kind of shocking speech where he attacked some of the poorest people in New Zealand, which was particularly an attack on Maori people, the indigenous people in New Zealand. This speech was riveting. It was kind of so unexpected that the whole country was transfixed by it. It was it's called a speech at Oriwa. That's how it's written, that the event is remembered. And it would transfix the nation because to have, in New Zealand particularly, such a respectable person giving what was in effect a very racist speech was unusual and kind of shocking and, as I say, transfixing. And this particular leader, whose name was Don Brash, rocketed up in the opinion polls. And his party, which had been languishing on low poll ratings, was suddenly set to win the next election, which they very nearly did, but not quite at that stage. So when this happened, I, like lots of people, thought, man, this is quite an astonishing and awful thing which has just happened in our country. What's going on here? What's actually going on inside this party? And what tricks were at work there? And, you know, how could I show that he was not telling the truth when he said this isn't racism, this was a very necessary nation-building speech and all the usual excuses you could imagine in those kind of politics? And so I set about the job of trying to get the inside story of what was going on with his leadership in that political party. As I say, lots of projects like this don't work, but in this case, I had the most amazing revelations. And that, not kind of, I didn't hear voices or anything. What I found was some really good sources. What I discovered was that this political party, which, as I was saying earlier, some people might assume that would be closed and united and nobody would be prepared to help someone like me who was trying to get information out of the public. In fact, it was an unhappy family. There were people who were really unhappy about this new leader coming in. They felt there'd been a kind of a takeover by the far right of their party, which among other things had a reasonably good record of not being racist in its politics. And so what I discovered was that far from being a closed shop to me, there were all kinds of people who were willing to help me. And I gradually had secret meetings. I had a year where I was meeting people in cars and side streets and anywhere where we wouldn't be seen, because I was meeting people who would be recognized, and I'm reasonably recognizable in this country. And we gradually worked towards more trust between me and them. And after a certain length of time, and this is the story I wanted to tell, they not only told me stories about what was happening in their party, but they provided me with what in the world is a really unusually large leak of information. So in a normal political party, the public just is getting very little of the truth of what's happening inside there. And most of what goes on is decided by the leader, the chief spin doctors and strategists and pollsters and speechwriters around the leader, and maybe one or two other elected politicians. That's the kind of nucleus of a modern political party, of the so-called centre-left and the so-called centre-right. It happened as a very centralised way that it gets organised. What happened was, which will probably never happen to me again and hasn't happened anywhere else I know in the world, is that somebody leaked me, quietly gave me thousands of internal communications between the leader and the speechwriter and the spin doctor and the party and the political strategist and a group of MPs, covering a whole 3 years of our country's history. They also gave me their polling results, their travel itineraries, their internal strategy reports and planning documents. So I had this pretty much unique bundle of documents from their day-by-day emails through to their strategy plans for a major political party, major Western political party, for 3 years of its history. I was able to write that into my last book, which is called The Hollow Men. And the reason I'm telling this is that when the book came out, there was the usual turbulence and name-calling. That leader of the party had to resign the day the book came out because there were so many revelations of things which he'd done wrong and which the dodgy things which his party had done, and, by the way, which other politicians, including our current Prime Minister, had been doing. But the reason I want to tell the story and use this opportunity, thank you, which you've given me, is that these things hardly ever happen. And although it's now 5 years since that book came out, that book, which I wrote, called The Hollow Men, based on all those emails and internal documents, is about as close up and as authentic a case study of how internal politics works as you'll find anywhere in the world. So if there are people listening who are actually interested in the subject of political management, spin doctoring, sort of the dynamics of right-wing political strategy, which is really what it comes down to, and issue management and management of public opinion, then it's a unique source. And I would recommend to people that they look at it, because it doesn't matter what country it is, a leak like that will hardly ever happen. And it was just the luck of me looking at the right time. And just to finish off the story, in terms of the satisfaction of doing the kind of research and digging that I do, is I not only found all sorts of dodgy things about their relationships with business industry groups, and that who their secret donors were, and how they manage and manipulate the public in an election campaign. But I also found the thing I'd been looking for, which was tremendously satisfying, which is that I found all the strategy papers and the draft speeches and the emails that led up to that original speech, which had motivated me, that original first racist speech. And I was able to do a chapter of the book detailing, in their own words, step by step, how they devised what they needed to do to try to lift their party up in the polls. And they cynically, completely cynically, from the very first beginning of the leadership, planned this racist speech purely as a way to capture a certain group of redneck voters and bring them on side in a dramatic way. So two things I'm saying here. One is that that can be tremendously satisfying to see something like that and take it from the beginning and expose it, something that you think is wrong in the world. But the other is that this case study of a right-wing political party for 3 years of its history is pretty unusual. In fact, it's almost unprecedented to get so much material about how they work inside. And if people are studying this or interested in it, I'd really recommend you dig it out and read it, because even though it's about New Zealand, the tactics and the mentality and the strategies and the dodging and the hiding and the way that they talk about manipulating the public are the same across similar parties and all similar countries. So thank you for the opportunity to tell people about that.
Yeah, well, it has to be done, you know. Everybody else doesn't take responsibility. And I chose to simply out of the fact that, well, every time I tried to tell the truth in the corporate environment, I wound up having to find another job, even though I was the best employee they had, you know? The whole thing just basically isn't fair, and I'm on this sort of quest to have some description of justice be done on this type of issue, because it is so important, it does affect all of us, and it needs to be exposed, because in a democracy, for it to work, you must have an informed public making informed decisions. And you can't have an informed public with a media that covers up information. So, Nikki Hager, thank you very much, investigative journalist, for joining me this hour. Coming up next hour, I have no idea. I'm not sure if you'll actually be keen to stay on for another whole hour, Nikki. I think you're a busy man. But, yeah, we'll think we'll open up the lines as well.
Thank you for having me on. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Nikki. You have yourself a fabulous day, exposing corruption and various other naughty stuff that you do.
Good. See you.